We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 19th. The time is 1:03 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Delana Johnson, who we will note is here in support of Representative Johnston, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Dave Tallarico, our Vice Chair, Representative Dean Westlake, Co-Chair, Representative Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast and our LIO moderator, Summers Cole, in it for the duration with us, I see. Thank you, guys. Please silence your cell phone if you could, and we won't have any unnecessary interruptions that way. Today we're going to hear two bills, House Bill 197, Community Seed Libraries. For real, we are really going to hear this bill for anyone listening in online, since this may be like time number four or five that this has been scheduled. So appreciate the sponsors' patience and flexibility in working with us. And I think we had travel issues as well. And the second bill, House Bill 107, Fish Enhancement Permits, from Representative Tallarico. So if you would like to come forward, we'll do House Bill 197 first. And I will just announce so that you know and can let me know, Representative Johnston, looks like we have one individual who's online for public testimony, maybe two, but then we also have Arthur Keyes, Director of Agriculture, and Rob Carter, Manager of the Plant Materials Center, online. So you know that they're there. And Representative Drummond has joined us. Hello. Okay, please go
ahead. Well, thank you, Co-Chair Tarr and the committee. I'm Jennifer Johnston, and I represent District 28, which is the Upper Hillside, South Anchorage to Portage. And everything is local, and this is one of those bills that even brings that to a point. It is even more local for me because it was brought to my attention by my daughter-in-law. So there is some familial locality to it. She is very much interested in growing her own and helping feed my son and our 10-month-old granddaughter. And last year, as she was experimenting and looking at heirloom seeds and what the restrictions were as far as exchanging locally, she came upon this and started doing research on it last fall and brought it to me. And she's a good daughter-in-law. and I felt she had a point, and so thus we have the seed bill. And I'm going to now turn it over to my very well-prepared aide, Terra Nova Tasker.
Hello. Terra Nova Tasker, staff for Representative Jennifer Johnston. This is my first hearing, so bear with me as I go through this. I will read through the sectional. The bill's pretty short, so I've got about seven sections. So Section 1 amends the duties of the Commissioner of Natural Resources to include development and regulation of non-commercial seed use in community seed libraries. Section 2 and Section 3 add subsection AS03.05.030 to allow an exemption for seed libraries from the regulations governing commercial seeds, as long as they comply with AS03.20.11, which are the guidelines for community seed libraries, and do not violate regulations that pertain to patent use without permission, be misrepresented in classification, or be prohibited by the department as a harmful seed. Section 4 adds a new section, 03.20.110, providing guidelines for seed libraries. An individual can establish a community seed library that allows for 100 grams of seeds for seed sharing. Packaging must include a label with the variety, the seller's name and address, and year of packaging, along with the weight of the contents. And must include a disclaimer statement that says, you know, not for commercial use. This section also directs the department to create a seed registry for publication online. Section 5, change to include language about community seed libraries in the statute regulating plant materials, plant material centers, which is already in existence, and part of, there's one in Palmer and part in the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Section 6 amends AS44.37.0303 to include community seed libraries in the information that the department must publish online and in print. And lastly, Section 7 is amended to include a subsection that allows the Department of Natural Resources to advise people interested in starting a community seed library on best practices and to submit information about the library without a fee. So, happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Thank you. I do just have one quickly. On Section 3, I think when you mentioned this reference, it's all the 0320, and I thought I heard 1-1, but it was the 110, right?
Yes.
Just that. Okay. They may have misheard that or anything. But any questions for the bill sponsor or her staff? Representative Parrish, and please let the record note that Representative Parrish joined us a couple of minutes ago.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 2, line 6, you make a pretty important change to the responsibilities of the Department of Agriculture by adding, I'll start reading on, well, just at the beginning, subsection 3, assist prospective settlers and others to engage in the agricultural industry by the state by providing information, activities, and programs essential to developing the agricultural industry and areas that are suitable for agriculture. And areas that are suitable for agriculture seems like a substantial increase in the responsibilities of the department. Am I mistaken in that?
I can answer that. Staff Representative Jennifer Johnston, Terranova. So when I talked to DNR, specifically Rob, at the Plant Materials Center when we were going through some of the language and how it affect, and, you know, this suitable for agriculture is wording that they liked and we liked as a way, you know, to kind of specify whatever area community garden might take, whether it's someone's, you know, backyard or, you know, some community land. And they didn't see it as an issue. Also, the seed statutes haven't been updated since like the 80s. So when legal and I were going through it, they, you know, there's a little bit of cleanup in the language that you'll see as well. And there's no fiscal note, or zero fiscal note with this bill. So the department has said that it won't cost them any more money to implement.
So. Okay.
Follow-up question, Representative Parrish?
I just suppose that I'm leery of, for instance, Representative Tallarico earlier on had a letter which I believe we all signed, saying that a bridge should be built to an area that's suitable for agriculture. And I just don't want the Department of Agriculture itself being an advocate for bridge building, necessarily. That seems outside of their main area of purview. And yet this would seem to add some responsibility to the department for that.
I think I'm going to, if we have someone from the department online, I'd be happy to refer that to them. You know, they didn't have any issues with the language, so I would be happy to let them speak on.
But this, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, and we do have Arthur Keyes, the Director of Agriculture, as well as Rob Carter, the Plant Materials Center manager online. And those questions, maybe we could ask for their input.
Sure. Let's see. Mr. Keyes, are you there?
Through the Chair, Representative Parrish, yes, I am.
Excellent. So on page 2, line 6, would you consider it an increase in your responsibility to assist with the developing of areas in the state that are suitable for agriculture?
Through the Chair, Representative Parrish, you know, from the Division of Agriculture standpoint, we see the entire state as having, you know, agriculture potential of some form or the other.
And
follow up? Mm-hmm.
And is it the responsibility of the department to help all regions of the state develop areas which are suitable to agriculture?
In regards to, Chair, Representative Parrish. In regards to agriculture, yes, but infrastructure, not necessarily. No.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really interesting. How is a community seed library defined? Is it defined in statute?
Through the chair, right now the term community seed library does not exist anywhere in the statute. So part of the reason this bill is going to be helpful is that it carves out a space in the statute that says, yes, seed libraries can exist. Here is the guidelines, the labeling part of, you know, a seed library. In other states that have gone through similar processes, they ran into the issue where because the way the statutes were written, you know, every seed was regulated as if it was a commercial seed. So that's extensive labeling, expensive testing. And so they, you know, Nebraska and Minnesota have gone through their statutes and specifically put in the word community seed library to help carve out this space for them. So that it's very clear and fine that, yes, community seed libraries can exist for non, you know, commercial use purposes.
Follow up?
So I imagine you should be defining community seed libraries in here. Does a community seed library include the seed exchanges that gardeners around the state are already holding each spring?
Yes, through the chair. So to answer your question, Article 1, Section A, Community Seed Libraries, lays out the guidelines for a community seed library. Kind of the issue that we've run into is there are some community exchanges, community seed exchanges happening around the state. Esther is probably the most, the largest one, for example. And unfortunately, because of the way the statute was written, any seed that is used for any capacity in the state, based on the way the regulations are written, has to go through that commercial process of extensive testing, you know, germination percentages, and labeling. So technically speaking, if a seed library were to exist today, it is in violation of the code. However, you know, I've talked to DNR and Rob specifically at the Plant Materials Center. They love seed libraries. They think it's a great idea. So there's no, you know, they're not slapping fees on current seed libraries, but they like this regulation because it does give them the authority to help and promote seed libraries. That answers your question.
I'm kind of confused. Does this mean that seed libraries are now that are now in existence in Alaska are doing something illegal that the department, that this bill wants the department to control? I'm not clear what the purpose of this bill is. If we've already got community seed libraries springing up in an organic, local way.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, I think you'll find that this bill actually strengthens seed libraries and gives them greater access to doing what they do best. We could be getting into federal problems if we don't do this.
Do you want to see if Mr. Carter has anything to add to that, Representative Drummond?
Yeah, that would be
because they in terms of the commercial context, the Plant Materials Center, where a lot of the seed potatoes are grown, you know, is engaged on the commercial side of things. So, Mr. Carter?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Drummond, if you could repeat your question.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. This is Representative Drummond. I represent Spinard, which has a farmer's market and lots of gardeners, and I'm getting a lot of feedback from constituents about what this bill means for their already existing informal, locally sprung up informal seed exchanges that gardeners hold around the state. What is this bill? What does this bill mean for those seed exchanges?
Through the chair, Representative, I guess I think I need to take a minute and outline a few things. At the Plant Materials Center, the Division of Agriculture, we do maintain and have the authority to regulate seeds, their transportation, their sales, their not sales within the state of Alaska. I think kind of listening in here, the basis of your initial question was, you know, what does this bill do if they're already there? Well, technically, seed libraries in the state of Alaska, any seed exchange in the state of Alaska, due to our current regulations, is against those regulations. It is not in the best interest of the division or genetic diversity of plants or food security in our state for the division to spend time and money to go out and for lack of better terms, harass a bunch of community-oriented folks that are sharing seed and providing opportunities for food security in their region to say you must follow these regulations that are really drafted for commercial use. So, yes, technically right now, non-commercial sharing of seed under our Prohibited Act section in our seed regulations is outlawed. I think that this bill, like many others around the country, are identifying that non-commercial use is important. It's probably as important as any issue we deal with in Alaska pertaining to food security. I think that people need to look at as crop genetic diversity, which is one of the foundation cornerstones of community seed sharing, is the most important key to sustainable agriculture and food security in any region of the world. And we're speaking only of Alaska right now. I think that the intent behind this bill and the communications I've had with the sponsor and her staff is that the intent behind this is to put it on in statute that this is a legal activity. It provides exemptions. Don't get me wrong. I think we could. There's another one in there that we need to have covered, and I've communicated that with the staff that needs to go in this bill to make sure that we secure this non-commercial seed sharing activity, either through a garden club or a fair or a seed library. We need that in the state of Alaska before other larger non-state entities come in and start pushing federal or state regulations against these practices.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, please, Mr. Carter. How is this not going to cost time and staff time and money for the Plant Material Center to manage these informal seed libraries that are already in existence?
Through the chair, Representative, the way this regulation or this legislation is written, it just says we may. It really doesn't direct us to have to do anything. And unless I see a shall in here in reference to community seed libraries, that to me is the legal language. By no means am I a lawyer. I'm a plant person. But at that time, I think that this legislation really just gives us an opportunity to say, if we have the time and extra resources in our already busy schedules, we could promote them, have a place on our internet, which I would love to see. Even as a seed consumer myself personally, would love to see a one-stop shop, a web page somewhere in the state of Alaska that identified all these seed sharing activities. I would be the first one there.
Okay. Or do you have another follow-up?
So, Mr. Carter, Are you going to reach out to folks somehow, or are you going to expect them to figure out that this exists and to get in touch with you?
Through the chair, Representative, I think that that's a multifaceted front with a lot of things that we work with in agriculture. I think that we have great resources with the utilization of Alaska Grown program, all of the individual gardeners and commercial farmers that we work with already. Once individuals identify that we have the ability to help support and promote their activities, a simple web page could get thrown up where an individual could, if they choose to, be part of that web page. I would say that I have more than once spoken to a lot of people that, you know, participate in these non-commercial seed sharing activities, and I think that the community is very well versed that this legislation is out there. And I think that, you know, some of them would be very happy to contribute their location and a contact phone number or even a date when they have community events where people could meet up and how they could exchange seeds.
Okay. I'm okay for now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Birch had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I seem to remember seeing a documentary one time about the sex life of a date. Could you kind of give me a quick rundown on the sex life of a delicious Matsu carrot? How does that carrot? Who controls the seeds? And for either the sponsor, this I'm curious as to how seeds that are you know commercial, how this would distinguish itself from the you know kind of care and custody of seeds and how they're generated and provided commercially and then privately. Whoever cares to answer that.
Do you want to have us? Okay. Mr. Carter, we're going to have you step in on that one, although it's making me want to talk about taking pantyhose and putting them over sunflower seeds and, you know, there's a lot of ways to collect seeds. Mr. Carter.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Birch had a question about distinguishing sort of this type of seed collection from commercial seed collection. And
for carrots, for instance, yeah, we've had delicious Matsu carrots. So I'm just wondering how those seeds are, where they come from and how they're preserved and maintained.
Through the chair, Representative, there's very limited carrot seed production in the state of Alaska. First and foremost, it's a biennial plant. I'm sure Madam Chair is probably laughing at this because it's general botany. Those plants flower on their second year of growth, so we don't do a lot of that production in the state of Alaska. Commercially, those are grown in areas like the Skagit Valley in Washington and other places all around the world where they are harvested with a combine like any other large seed-scale production. They are clean tested to meet both the state and federal regulations. I won't get into much more depth than that. Then they are basically sold through brokers. For a carrot seed that gets planted on the commercial scale here, most of the farmers order those from a very large agribusiness that is in the sale of selling tons of seed at a time. And those seeds that are sold commercially have very strict federal and state guidelines to make sure that they are following both the state regulations and the Federal Seed Act of whatever state they're going to be sold or entered into commerce to.
Okay, so follow up, Madam Chair. So when we talk about regionally adapted seeds harvested from plants grown in state, we're looking at this is not necessarily a commercial operation. It would basically be a, as we've talked about here a little earlier, that would be basically a mechanism for putting into place a framework for kind of monitoring and permitting through the internet an exchange of Alaskan grown seeds.
Representative, I don't think it has really any monitoring requirements in this legislation. I don't think that there is really any need of any. Non-commercial use tends to be relatively small scale. It's individuals like myself or you or your next door neighbor or a group of individuals to get together that may want to try to overwinter some carrot stecklings, replant them in the ground, collect seed from them the following year, and then share that amongst themselves. These tend to be they're normally not hybrids. They're normally heirloom or open pollinated varieties that have been around for decades, if not longer than that. They're in small quantities. The real key to it is individuals that find a type of seed or a variety of seed, genus or species, a carrot, a broccoli, a cauliflower, that produces well in their region, Sitka, Palmer, Fairbanks, Kotzebue, they in turn could harvest seed off that and legally share it amongst themselves with no ramifications of either the Federal Seed Act or our state seed regulations, while not impeding our commercial seed regulator or seed producers and sellers as well.
Thank you, sir. Sounds like a reasonable proposal to me.
Any other questions? Okay. Representative Johnson.
I just have a comment. Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. I just wanted to say that when I was in my early teenage years, I worked in a gift store that sold little packages of Alaska seeds, and they were some hand-printed up label and so on. And so, and they were wildly popular, to fireweed seeds and so on. And then one day I went up to get some at some point, and they told me that they couldn't sell them anymore, that it was couldn't be done, you know, it was regulated out of possibility. Anyway, that was one of those first moments in my life of what is happening, and and why, and, you know, one of those just kind of a, I specifically remember it, and that's why when Representative Johnston brought this forward into my attention, I was pleased to add on as a co-sponsor, just because, I mean, if criminals can't trade, if you make criminals of those of us that trade seeds, then only criminals will trade seeds.
Thank you, Representative Johnston. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. It's just been revealed to me, and I'm shocked that my dear departed granny was a hardened criminal. A good proportion of the plants being grown right now in Haines come from her garden. She was really, really generous with the community in providing starts and seeds. And I can't help but to want to vindicate her in posthumously. So where exactly in statute is the line that makes my dear old granny a criminal?
Through the chair. So this is kind of a two-part answer to that. So in the statute, let me just make sure I've highlighted everything correctly here. So on page 2, lines 16 and 17, so this portion establishes the regulating of seeds, whether they're sold or not sold, for use in the state of plants, seeds, vegetables. So the department that establishes the department is regulating this.
That's already in there, though.
Yes. So that's...
So they're changing.
Right. And then page 3, lines 1 through 7 at the top there. So that pertains to the labeling requirement. So any product that's being used, sold, exchanged must be labeled. And so you then need to go to the code, the administrative code, which is chapter 34, I believe, that outlines the two pages of labeling requirements. So that's where it sets out the germination percentage, the weight. So combining those two parts together is where we get the it's almost impossible for a seed library to currently exist. And I've confirmed that with Rob as we've been discussing this back and forth, because the statute is complicated and needs some updating. But those are the two sections we look to when we are dealing with this issue.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So on page 3 here, I see that it's the commissioner may adopt rules, regulations, and procedures. And I'm to understand then that the commissioner has adopted rules and procedures, which make it make all of our little seed libraries in the state right now and all of our individuals sharing in the seeds right now, if not criminals, then at least engaged in extra legal activity.
Yes, that is correct. But I would, I'm going through this the first time. So Rob, I would definitely refer that question to Rob as well to give some backup, as he's been in the department for a long time and working with these regulations back of his hand. So.
Sure. I'll happily pass the question along to Rob.
Sure. Please.
So am I to understand that it's a regulatory hurdle which a past commissioner has put in place that makes seed sharing by private individuals and seed libraries technically illegal?
For the record, this is Rob Carter from the Division of Ag Plant Material Center. Through the chair, representative. Yes, I can actually give you what I believe is the biggest hurdle. I will say that and give a precursor out there, in other states that have come down hard on seed libraries and non-commercial seed sharing, that comes to interpretation of their regulations and definitions of word, offered for sale, barter, trade. But what really hinders non-commercial use and your grandma in the state of Alaska is under 11 AAC 34.0.075, where it states that no person and you'll have to hear me out on this one, may sell, offer for sale, which we know the seed libraries aren't doing, expose for sale, but then the key to this is for transfer for use in planting in the state any agricultural or vegetable seed. And if you follow that down in that same regulation to number 5, that has not been tested within 18 months preceding that transportation. So technically, any individual that is moving seed in the state of Alaska with no quantity defined, one seed or 100 million, that currently doesn't have the labeling requirements, which are required by the 18 months of testing, is breaking our current regulation. Yes, that is long before I worked here in the state of Alaska. It's really around the country, and here that that language is utilized to make sure that seed getting moved around normally doesn't have invasive weeds in it, and that's why they've always followed that testing requirement. But that is really the tripping hurdle there, that anyone that's transporting seed with the intended use to plant that does not have testing, which is required by the labeling requirements in Chapter 34, is breaking our regulations.
Mm-hmm. Just for the record, I hate that.
I do not disagree.
Well, it's just regulation. Can't you solve that problem by regulation, say, if you're transporting more than 100 pounds of seed? That's the scale where I'd start to get worried. But if it's just a handful of seeds for a beautiful flower that's getting carried across town, and dear old granny did introduce some invasive flowers, which have largely been suppressed. Why don't we have a lower bound on the applicability of that? Because seed sharing is something that people have been doing as long as we've had agriculture. I mean, it's just astounding to me that we can't have it in some form without it being in technical violation of the law.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Carter?
Chair Representative, yes, you are correct. And we have full intent to review and update and modernize, is what I would call it, our regulations. I think that, you know, it's a very difficult situation because we do have a lot of commercial seed production in the state of Alaska. A lot of people don't realize that. But we do, and so we would rather, you know, see those exemptions made for the non-commercial use than to modify things that may jeopardize seeds being transported or sold, offer for sale within the state that don't meet our regulation requirements. We don't want to have any loopholes in there where an individual that's trying to stay below the radar. And really, the seed regulations are not there to stop you from doing something. They're more there for consumer protection, right? So that if I go to the store and buy seed, it is what it says on the label. The germination is what it is. It doesn't contain any noxious weeds that I don't want on my property. So I think, and then second to that, me saying, oh yeah, I'll change my regulation so that we don't impede non-commercial use or seed libraries. You're only taking my word for it. And if I happen to get run over by a bus and someone else comes in, that could very well change. So I like the idea that the individuals in Junos can put this type of language in statute that protects this this type of activity for generations to come.
And a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll also say that I hope that you don't get run over by a bus. But I'd be happy to take your work pending that, that you would be willing to change the statute, maybe just by adding the word commercial or for commercial purposes, so that we can, without having someone wouldn't have to go through a official seed library in order to legally be sharing seeds with their neighbors. And then under the seed library portion of this bill, it says that before you, well, it says first that you cannot give more than 100 grams of one variety to someone in 12 consecutive months. That's depending on the sort of seed. Like if you're talking cherry pips, you get there comparatively quickly.
Through the chair, mm-hmm. We actually have some amendments that we're looking at presenting. I was just waiting for the proper time.
Sure. The labeling requirements are a little stringent for what would normally just be in a a Ziploc bag and hand it off at the grocery store or where have you.
Through the chair, I can address that to some extent. So, yes, we do have 5 requirements for labeling. I will say this is a downgrade from 2 pages worth of requirements. And, you know, this is something I've talked to Rob about, and, you know, we do have some wiggle room with this. He was saying that as far as the department's concerned, in his view, you know, someone could have the sign or the statement not authorized for commercial use just up in the space. Not every single package would have to have that on. Seller's name and address, you know, if that's kept in a binder, not necessarily on the package of seed. But, I mean, something as simple as species and variety, I mean, I think that could be purple flower. Seems like a reasonable request. And the weight of the package is important when we do go to when we move our requirement up to 1 pound, just as a general keeping track of things that are moving. But I don't, I think in the scale of things, these requirements are pretty limited. But of course, this is a fluid process, so we're working through those concerns.
Sure.
And while we're just before we go to Representative Johnson's question, while we're on that for Mr. Carter, because those are 2 concerns that were raised to me through an email, the 100-gram limit and then also the labeling. But I just want to have you take one moment and differentiate how this is going to be different from, you know, if I just want to collect some of my own seed and give to a friend, that's going to be different than these or the, you know, for individuals that want to participate in a community seed library. And so just can we differentiate that for just a moment?
Yes, Madam Chair, we definitely can. I think the easiest way, I think this the intent of this legislation, in my opinion, professional opinion, I guess here, is that that this is for community seed libraries and in a package that's defined in a place where, you know, individuals can go and use those seeds. You know, I personally, you know, have reread this thing multiple times, and I think that both the bill sponsor and her staff, you know, have identified that, oh, it doesn't really say in here where you or I could individually share seeds. It doesn't provide that exemption. But I think that's a very easy additional operation to put into Article 1. But I do think that this defines this. I think that, you know, that there's some amendments that need to be heard before we can really discuss those too much further.
Okay. I appreciate that. I think that's one of the things maybe we could do, too, to just sort of differentiate that because, and granted, as a botanist, I've been spending a lot of time growing plants for a lot of years, but for the people who are going to collect seed to contribute to a community seed library, they're going to want to put the genus, species, variety information on it. I mean, just those are people that are, you know, sort of one step up, I would say, from, you know, folks that buy a few plants and have a pot in front of their house, right? So so I think we might want to think about sort of, you know, sort of segregating that a little bit, but I don't think those labeling requirements really for the individuals who'd want to participate seem to be too much. Representative Johnson.
So who knew that we had the Alaska Seed Exchange Democracy Act? I won't go through and read that. I have very, very, well, let's see. This is unwanted, and alarming legislation. So I guess I didn't know everyone took this so seriously, but... And I'm sure your name is on these letters as well. I guess what I wanted to know is if you had some of these concerns, I think, are maybe based on some misinformation. But I was wondering if you had taken a look through these concerns and had, I thought I heard you say something about potential amendments. And if you were, I mean, obviously, we're getting kind of close to the end of the session, and I would think that you probably, if it doesn't get through this year, we'll have a robust discussion over summer with some of your seed people and probably address some concerns. Is that what I heard?
Yes, and through the chair, if you would permit Terra Nova to discuss the suggested amendments.
Okay.
Great.
And so just before, so Rob Carter had mentioned, he suggested, is that in your things you're going to talk about, or should we ask him for his input on that?
I'll go through mine, and I should, I believe I've included all of his suggestions, but Rob, if you want to chime in afterwards.
And then can I just say really quickly, because in addition to the two concerns, the 100-gram limit and then the labeling that were brought up, the requirement to be grown in state, that was something that was brought up. So if you're going to address that, and then Rob, and then also seeds that hadn't been treated. And that I'm actually okay with, but if that's a concern, so maybe we could have you guys go through it and hear from Rob.
Yeah, absolutely. So through the chair, so we are working on a couple amendments, and this came out of hearing back from the seed libraries. As the representative did point out, there has been some miscommunication about what the bill does, and so our office and the other co-sponsors have been working really hard to communicate with the different stakeholders about what the bill specifically does. It's tricky. It took me quite a few times to read the statute to understand what it was, so I know it can be challenging to navigate this language. So the proposed amendments, we have an amendment that would include seeds that aren't specifically grown in Alaska. And so, for example, the seed library said that they often get donations, from Home Depot or other entities, and they'd like to be able to put those in their seed libraries, which, I mean, that makes perfect sense. If a seed's traveling from out of state, it's already gone through a labeling process as part of the federal interstate commerce rules. So that would be important. It gives, Bell's Nursery, for example, the opportunity to help these seed libraries. So that's an amendment we're working on. Also, the big concern was changing the weight limit to 1 pound. And that, after talking with Rob, that should cover most seeds. I mean, you don't really grow coconuts in Alaska, so some seeds just aren't really an option. And then we did want to address the issue about marijuana seeds. So we do have an amendment that would prohibit marijuana seeds from the seed library exchange. It's just not, we don't believe that's the purpose of the seed library, and not something we want to stick our hands in, I guess, at the moment. And so those are the amendments coming forward. And then the one that Rob had mentioned about a personal exemption, that one I can work on some wording for with legal, but those should address the concerns.
Any questions about those proposed amendments?
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just so long as personal, non-commercial seed sharing is given an explicit, it's okay. It's like if you're walking across a meadow and there's one little path that's been laid out and there's a sign that says, it is legal to walk on this path. Suddenly you got to have doubts about any other way you might try to get from point A to point B.
Okay. And we had, in some of the communication received, that what were the other states? California is one of the states that's recently done a seed one. Nebraska or Missouri, I want to say. Let's see. California, Nebraska, Illinois, and Minnesota. So I don't know if we have, but we'll put, we have a copy of the California one, and we'll put that up on the website if anybody wants to look at that. All of those suggested amendments cover the issues that I was concerned about. Mr. Carter, did you want to say anything about any of those amendments or the personal exemption portion of it we kind of covered a moment ago?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think I could provide a few comments. Some of them I may have not talked to the bill sponsor about. I guess first and foremost, let's talk about the 100-gram requirement. I don't see any issues with moving that up. Again, I know I've heard some communications out there that people were concerned about items such as potatoes or root cuttings or other items. This is just a lack of their, formality with our regulations. We define those like bulbs, pips, grafts, buds, cyanwood, corms, if you want to get into the botany of it. Those are actually plants. Those aren't regulated under our seed regulations. So that would be no restriction there if it was 1 or 100 pounds. I do feel that could be in the pounds area without directly impacting anything. and still providing the opportunity. I definitely think that the language, knowing agronomically that we cannot produce all seeds in Alaska, that individuals get them from their grandparents from other states or from friends and from cousins, or purchase seed from outside the state of Alaska that they want to use for non-commercial seed sharing activities, that exemption needs to be there. I think easily in the section of Article 1A, community seed libraries, there could be an amendment to that where it provides an exemption for non-seed library seed sharing activities. That's if I chose to give you, Madam Chair, a package of seeds for your garden or vice versa. I think that within this, it's up to the bill sponsor for the language that's required on packaging. When I read this current legislation, I kind of see that this could be pretty easily done by a community seed library with a single sign written on cardboard if they choose, above their seed sharing activities or within their seed sharing opportunities, that just stated these are seeds grown, for use, non-commercial, and that'd meet the requirements of this. I definitely feel that, that this is important, and I definitely want that on the record that, Alaska is lucky because we have isolation. We don't have large agriculture that tends to, push a little heavier on these types of regulations in the state of Alaska. And that the opportunity for non-commercial use and seed libraries, is what's going to really provide long-term sustainability and self-reliance in the state of Alaska. Because people in remote areas or non-remote areas may not have access to seed, but they may have access to seed that's been grown generationally in their region. Having an agricultural system that's adapted to these community environments, to these self-reliance, is a large portion of agriculture, sustainable agriculture, in a state like Alaska.
Thank you. Appreciate those comments. Any questions for Mr. Carter? I have to mention that tomorrow in Mountain View, there's a seed library kickoff where they're going to be showing the movie Growing Cities, which is about the growing movement to take these issues on. If anybody's going to be in Anchorage at 2:30 p.m., Mountain View just got a farmer's market last year, which has been really successful, and I'm gonna try to attend that event if I can get home. So just goes to show this is a timely issue and something that people are really interested in. We'll go ahead and, if there are no other questions at this time, open up public testimony. We have a few people online. So we'll go ahead and open public testimony. And I guess I'll ask also, is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. Then we will go first to Grace Johnston. And I'm just wondering by the last name if this might be the daughter-in-law who suggested this bill.
Hi, yes, I am Grace Johnston, Jennifer Johnston's daughter-in-law.
Welcome.
I feel passionately about this bill because in the present I am invested in Anchorage gardening and love the way that a summertime garden can provide fresh and very nutritious food for my family, because the longer that produce sits on a shelf, the fewer nutrients it has. There's a time decay for nutrition in produce. So being able to pick directly from the garden to the table is very important to me. And I am firmly invested in the future of Alaskan gardening. Through my young daughter, I would like her to be able to grow up in a state where the specialized seeds that can flourish in Alaska that are cold and sun adapted are readily available, because these seeds are not commercially viable for larger seed producers to make down in the lower 48 or around the world. So it's important for us to make sure that we can legally and widely share these throughout our state. And by explicitly allowing for seed libraries, we ensure that legacy remains not only for our present, but for my daughter's future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Johnston? Well, thank you for bringing this forward. I'm a botanist, and I love working on these issues, so this is a, I like this bill a lot. Next, we'll go to Patricia Tridite from Dillingham. Hi, if you would please state your name for the record, and then we'd be pleased to take your testimony.
Yeah, this is Patricia Tridite from Dillingham, representing myself. I support the bill with reservations. I think if the subject hadn't been brought up, we wouldn't need to do it. But there are some concerns that we need to protect. Well, the first thing I want to bring up is language. As I'm reading it, it's saying seller as the person giving out the seeds. Is that the correct term, or we have to invent a term here, exchanger or sharer or some such?
Do you have a specific reference to a spot in the bill you're looking at? That might be helpful.
I don't have it in front of me, no. But when I was reading through it earlier, it was referencing seller, and we're not talking about selling here. Am I incorrect in this?
Nope, we're looking at it. This is in the labeling portion of the five things that need to be mentioned for that, and it says the seller's name and address. So maybe that.
Yeah.
We're getting nodding from the sponsor and her staff, so they're taking note of that concern.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if we have a term for what it should be, but I don't think it should be seller. The other thing which has been brought up previously is the 100 grams, particularly if, say, you wanted to grow a quarter acre of grain to feed your chickens, 100 grams isn't going to get you very far. I think that needs to be addressed and is going to be. The other thing that I wanted to see addressed is commercially in the state we've got a pretty viable seed potato industry, and potatoes aren't addressed here either in starred or seed form. Apparently seed potatoes would not be included, but potato seeds, tomato seeds, eggplant seeds, anything of that can all carry late blight, and tomato seeds are one of the most precious and often exchanged seeds, so because they're easy to save. But do we need to address this? I mean, we do want to protect the potato industry, and maybe the agricultural guys can address this, but it seems like it could be a concern.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that's all my concerns at this point.
Okay, and since we have the time today, I'm just going to see if Mr. Carter wants to address that, because I think on seed potato, you're required to purchase certified seed potato, but on the other plants in that family, I don't have the answer for that. Mr. Carter?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Did you hear the concern there about other potential seeds? And is it true on seed potatoes, they all have to be certified seed potato for purchase in the state?
Or commercial use, that is correct.
And then the concern about the other plants, do you think that should be specifically mentioned or differentiated in any way?
As live plants, yes, but we're only talking about seeds, so I don't believe that it's necessary in this. I think that the amount of seeds that are traded by individuals around the state within that family is the easiest thing is for seed savers is they don't look for plants that have disease, that biologically aren't in good shape. They're allowing fruit to go to maturity so that the seeds mature. And in a late blight infected tomato plant would be a very poor performer. It would not be in the best interest of anyone to maintain it or collect seed from it. And yes, I think we do currently have registrations for tomato, live tomato plants being shipped into the state of Alaska, including potatoes, within that family. But in this non-commercial seed sharing use, I don't feel that it is necessary.
Okay, and under the Section 6 where the duties of department are discussed, this gives you the ability to publish information about seed libraries, and perhaps that would be some of the information that you would put on that, you know, to direct seed libraries to be, you know, careful in terms of what they, you know, what they, the kind of information they share with the participants in that community seed library so that we could prevent things like that.
Yes, Madam Chair. You know, currently we don't have the authority to really spend any time or effort working with the non-commercial use of seed, even though seed is really very well up our ballgame. So I believe that this legislation, and specifically that section, provides us that opportunity to not regulate, but just to help promote and identify non-commercial seed sharing activities around. And I'm very comfortable with that.
Excellent. Let's go to our last testifier, David Otness from Cordova.
Good afternoon, Chairman Carr, Co-Chair Josephson, and resource members. Yeah, I'm speaking on behalf of approximately 160 gardeners here in Cordova, whether they know it or not. I'm speaking on behalf. We want to see anything we can done to facilitate transfer of seeds and to get the agricultural awareness on the up and up. I think everybody's readily seen how it's taken off in terms of people wanting to grow their own food. And so anything we could do on this basis to make it legal or make it not illegal would be certainly a good thing. And with that, having gone through the bill, I need to speak for myself here. On page 2, line 25, parentheses 6, what in the heck are we talking about regulating the farming of elk in this bill for? I mean, that my spidey sense is going, woo, woo, woo. Is this a game farm? Is this for slaughter? How did this show up in here? If somebody could address that, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Otness, that's actually an existing statute, and so that part is not being added. That's under the current duties of the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, but when that section of statute is amended, the whole section will show up in the bill. So that's actually existing language and not being changed by this legislation. But you know, we did have the DNR Deputy Commissioner and Ledge Liaison here moments ago, and we could have asked them for comment on that, but that is currently part of the responsibilities of the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, very good. I guess that slipped by me, and everything else is going on. I had no idea we'd gotten to that point in Alaska, so I guess I'll have to research that. But, okay, well, thank you very much for clarification, and good luck with the rest of the session. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Otness, you know, if you're going to look at that up, check out the state veterinarian website because there's more discussion about it there of who's doing what.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't have any other callers here in the public testimony, so I'll go ahead and close public testimony. We will hold this bill over. Sounds like you're preparing some amendments. We could meet and we could also consider a committee substitute. If there's, you know, three or four different pieces, maybe that's a way we can address them all at once. And it sounds like there's a lot of support on the committee, so I think that would be supported if we went that avenue. I'm not seeing any opposition. We'll have to check with Representative Rauscher since he's absent. But thank you so much for bringing this bill forward, and then we'll follow up so we can bring it back up as soon as possible and maybe at least get it through this committee.
Yeah. Great. Thank,
thank
you.
You. Thank you.
You very much.
Okay, we are going to transition to House Bill 107. Put Representative Tallarico on the hot seat. Okay. You would please both state your name for the record, and we're happy to have your bill in front of us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dave Tallarico. I'm the representative for District 6.
And for the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Tallarico.
Madam Chair, are you ready for me to begin?
Ready for you
okay,
to begin.
Thank you. And I know that we have quite a few people, so I'll be as brief as I usually am, Madam Chair. thank you very much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it, and I'll extend that to the committee members as well. Thanks for hearing the bill. House Bill 107 is a fish rehabilitation bill. So the permit that's described in the bill could boost fertilized fish eggs to the fry stage and from their natural survival rates of 5% in nature to 95% through incubation. The fish eggs would be collected, fertilized, incubated, hatched, and released back in the same water as unfed fry. My estimation, without it being completely natural, this is as natural as we can possibly make fish to actually rehabilitate or grow populations. Fish incubation, of course, is not new, and we've been doing it in Alaska for nearly 40 years in many areas throughout the state. Similar permits for education and science exist, but this bill would clean things up by outlining these permit requirements in statute and for the purposes of rehabilitation. In other words, to actually do a rehabilitation project and not have it labeled as either an education or science project, but to be able to utilize it as a rehabilitation project. This creates the ability for us to do this as a collaborative effort with private sector nonprofits out there, completely under the department's direction, but having participation from others out there to actually do this. Part of my motivation here, Madam Chair, is we're all aware of some of our fiscal constraints that we currently have, and we do have at least one for sure, a very interested party that would like to participate and thinks that they have the ability to potentially leverage funds and use some of their own funding to do this, as to where it might be a little tough for us right now, you know, with the financial situation we find ourselves in. So I want to make clear this is a retread bill. I've been down this path before, and one of the I don't know if it was necessarily misconception, but it was certainly declared at one time as being bucket biology and anyone could do this. If you really look at the permit and you look at the requirements there, this will not be an easy permit to obtain. There are certainly a lot of hurdles, and not necessarily hurdles, but requirements for an applicant to be able to satisfy before they can even head down this road, and it requires department approval. And it would also provide one of the responsibilities will be for them to also stay engaged with the department to provide data as a kind of a continuation of the project. So just one of the things I might mention is, as we've done this, a lot of people will view this differently, and some see it as an opportunity, I think, to some will see it as an absolute disaster, no doubt, but some see it as an opportunity to maybe provide more for sport fishermen, potentially for commercial fishermen, although this isn't really as much as, say, some of the hatcheries that we have in the state, which I support as well, by the way. This isn't a hatchery replacement bill. I support the operation of these hatcheries. They've done a fine job everywhere where they're operating. But for me and the particular district that I represent, this is actually this is a food source bill. My district begins in Tanana on the Yukon River and goes all the way to the Canadian border. So basically half of the Yukon River, all of the upper Yukon, is within my district, as well as a fair portion of the Tanana River. These are two enormous river systems in the state, really big, and that traditionally have had runs in them. And right now, recent news, in fact, we've had some closures. We've had a closure down here in southeast because there's not enough fish. Recently had a closure, I believe, in the Kuskokwim drainage, closures in the Yukon, and we're evidently struggling keeping fish populations up. And for my folks and the folks that I represent, this is a critical food source for them. Traditionally, they have used this as a food source for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And currently, that option appears to be going away. So for me, this is a really good attempt, anyway, to figure out a way to get this back so that they can do that and continue to fish from Tanana all the way up to Eagle, and particularly in the Yukon. You know those, and you guys are familiar with the villages along the Yukon. I mean, they've had fish wheels there for centuries, and limiting their fish it's been a critical food supply for them for a long time. So that's kind of the way I view it. We're really hoping to do something with it. But at that, Madam Chair, I'll quiet down and take over and explain the bill a little more in detail if you'd like.
Can we hold questions till he does the sectional, and then we'll do that? Is that okay? Mr. Verhagen, please continue.
Yeah, for the record, again, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff representative Tallarico. So in statute currently, AS 1605050, bullet 5, one of the duties of the Commissioner of Fish and Game is to propagate fish or increase fish populations throughout the state. So the department has done this, as was mentioned, with educational and science permits. And so these permits, which is similar to the permit that we're proposing, and again in working with the department on crafting the criteria, etc., starting on page 2, line 2, on down through the bill, is requirements that the permit applicant would have to fill out, their name, their reasons for doing this, the conditions justifying the project, communication, that ample communication they've had with affected people in the area, the location, how many fish they're going to collect, fish eggs, etc., their plan for incubation. All of this is specified on for good reasoning, similar to their education science permits, to make sure that Joe Schmo isn't able to go get a permit. We want this to be a very safe, reasonable process to propagate fish. So in that statute I just quoted, the commissioner has, over the years, they've come up with these science and educational permits that are very similar, but they're nowhere in statute. And so what this bill is doing is getting a fish permit in statute, but also, as was mentioned by the representative, we have at least one interested party, TCC, who's on the line, and they'll be talking later, that is ready to invest their money, private dollars, into doing it. Obtaining one of these permits. They already have worked out with a biologist who's done this fish incubation, and to be able to responsibly and safely boost the fish populations in the Nenana and Yukon rivers. So we. Again, we'll hear from them later. With the science and education permits, such entities would have to apply and get one of these permits, and do it under the premise of science or science collection or education. Whereas this bill is allowing them to get a permit simply because they need more fish. Escapement goals haven't been met. Many rivers, they don't even have escapement goals because our resources are limited, and we don't even do fish counting in many of our rivers. And so, but the locals can definitely attest and say we are not getting near as many fish by the time they get up to them in the interior, especially. So this will be getting one of these types of permits in statute as well, so it will be there. Each permit has to be signed by the Commissioner of Fish and Game. Again, with all these other checks and balances on page 2 from bullet 1 to bullet 8, and then starting on page 2, line 24, the department may issue a permit. They have full latitude to reject an application or ask them to amend it, etc., if they don't feel the person or the organization, etc., is qualified. With the science and education permits, however, they are opened up to governmental agencies and schools. However, businesses, etc., are ineligible. And again, the hope of this bill is, and it's stated in the bill further, we want the private sector to collaborate under the oversight of Fish and Game to use their private dollars to boost fish populations. But they're not going to be able to say, these are our fish, so you can't touch them. The fish will be open to everyone that come from these rehabilitation projects. And so it's in the best interest of everyone that to get more, as many natural fish as possible. So if I'd like to turn your guys' attention to, in the we have in your packet an egg survival comparison of salmon naturally spawning versus assisted spawning. Shows some salmon eggs there. So when you get to that page, in nature, for various factors, when the salmon spawn, their eggs, many of them, will wash away. They won't have gotten fertilized in time before they, you know, get washed down these quick streams, rapid streams. Sometimes there are many predators, other trout, other fish that will be eating their eggs, bears even. Some of them will get covered over by silt. Sometimes the water tables will drop in the middle of winter and freeze and ruin these fish eggs. So with all these factors, the survival rate from fertilized egg to emergent fry is about 5%. And through incubation, we can increase that survival rate. It's been proven for the past 40 years. And again, they'll be online to talk about this with the Gulcana Hatchery, etc., that have done this. They've been able to successfully get around 90 to 95% survival rate from fertilized egg to fry. So, as stated earlier, we are putting the fry that are unfed, written in the bill, back into the water to eliminate messing with, they're not even being fed, no risk of changing their genetics or anything, and they're put back in the same river they were taken out of. And then they, from the get-go, are just like any other emergent fry. They have to learn how to fend for themselves very naturally. And so that's what this permit would allow qualified individuals, corporations, etc., to do, is to use their resources, their money, to first prove through this process that is outlined in here, that they know what they're doing. I like to give an example. I've been working on this all session, and I have a pretty good idea of how to do this, I think, now, and yet I still would probably be rejected if I turned in an application because, first of all, I don't have the money or resources to get the incubation equipment, etc., or build the troughs, and they'll talk about this in just a second from the Gulcana Hatchery, but they've even use the natural hot springs to adjust the water temperatures throughout the winter when these eggs are eyeing and growing, and so that's pretty cool, that method. But I would probably myself be denied an application, and yet I've been researching this for the past session three months. So it's you have to know what you're doing to get one of these permits. And then they would last for 5 years, so they would be able to see the return on these on their efforts. And also, if you go to page 3, line 26, it says a permittee shall collect and provide project data and reports reasonably requested by the department. So, again, the department's doing a great job. However, our resources, our money is limited. There's many, many rivers and streams that there we have no idea what the – there's no escapement goals. There's no fish counts, et cetera. But, again, there's locals that depend on this food. So if they were to put in an application and say, I'm going to be doing this on the upper Nenana River, then if another person comes along a month later and says, I want to do this on the upper Nenana River, the department would be able to look at that and say, well, we've already approved this permit in that location, so either change your location, or if the department saw fit that they could have two permits in the same area and that would not overpopulate the stream or the river, then they would, again, that would be at the discretion of the commissioner of Fish and Game. And then these permittees shall, or they'll be providing this data that the department would otherwise not have on many of these rivers and creeks. that is what the bill does. And again, we have a lot of the experts that have been doing this for years online to talk about this, and we're here for questions.
Okay, so we'll start with questions for the bill sponsor, and then we have Mr. Bowers, the Deputy Director for Division of Commercial Fisheries. So we'll invite you up afterwards, and you can tell us a little bit more, just so we sort of parse out our questions, because we heard this bill in fisheries. Tell us a little bit more about what you're doing currently, and how this would sort of change that. So that would help differentiate that. But I know he's the better one to talk about that. So Representative Birch and then Josephson had questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my high privilege early on in my career to actually be the project manager on the Sicu Celiac Springs Hatchery in the lower reaches of the Noatak River in District 40. And I could realize what an advantage it is to have, to supplement the natural run of salmon here, and I know one of the challenges is making sure it's a natural run, and I very much appreciate the sponsor in the time in the background in kind of proving that up, that you actually are taking putting the salmon back in the stream where they started. The survival rate's phenomenal. It almost appears to be a kind of a crowdsourcing, if you will, for salmon, I like the idea. I'd be interested in hearing if anybody's got a downside, what that could possibly be, because it looks to me like it supplements the food source and really leverages the resource there. So good to see this, and looking forward to supporting it. Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Tallarico, just a handful of questions. I think one of the concerns I have is in Section 2, where the commissioner could make findings that plans and specifications for proposed construction or work would be satisfied by showing that this was an alternative means of rehabilitation. And I guess my concern is that rather than on doing everything we can to restore wild salmon streams, we're sort of punting and going this other route. And can you try to allay my concerns?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, thank you. We've really successfully done this in the Copper River drainage for a long time, and when we get to that point, when they describe to you what they've actually done in the Gulcana Hatchery, I think you'll be just as shocked as me to find out that information of how they've kind of carefully maneuvered there, keeping wild salmon stock available, but the actual volume. I've driven by the Gulcana Hatchery several times, and I have to be honest with you, I thought it was just a tool shed with a sluice box sticking out of it. I was never very impressed with what I kind of saw there. I've realized that the people that have operated it, not just Fish and Game, but from the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association, I think it's called, or something, and have done that. It's absolutely remarkable how they've managed to do that, still keep wild stock in the Copper River, but the volume of fish that they've put down there for people to utilize on a regular basis. So they're certainly much more qualified to talk about that than I am. But actually, we're nearly... everybody wants to give it different titles and everything. I would say that my constituents in the upper Yukon River are at crisis levels right now with fish. Sometimes I hear people joke about it once in a while, say, oh, yeah, they're down to one, they're down to this, they're down to that. Not funny if you live in Fort Yukon or Rampart or Tanana or any of those communities along there. Seriously, traditionally, and what they've been able to do over the years, that is actually a real crisis right there. I think it's critical for us to come up with the very best plan we can and take action and try and get these supplies replenished for those folks. It's been shown, and you'll probably have people say, well, it's going to be detrimental to the wild stock and everything, but the honest truth is the taking that's required in that river right now for those folks and where our levels have gotten, We need to take some action and do something and get fish back to these people. It's as simple as that. That really needs to happen. The one thing I'm trying to avoid is all of the theories of why we don't have fish. Because we could sit here and we can spend the next 10 years like we have the previous 10 years pointing the finger at either sport fishermen or subsistence fishermen or commercial fishermen and get absolutely nowhere. Unfortunately, I think that's kind of a place where we've gotten. Everybody wants to point the finger at others, cut the user groups out. And what I'm really looking for is resolution to satisfy the user groups, to make sure that we have subsistence fish, sport fish, and commercial fishing is vital to Alaska's, you know, our its employment, its economy. So that's where I'm really going to. And I don't think we're not replacing wild stock here, what we're doing. And this is as, the honest truth is, I think this is as wild as it gets. Like I said, some people were worried, well, he's trying to replace all the other hatcheries with this because he thinks it's better than those. I support these other hatcheries. I really do. I think they do a great job. But gone down to the one down here, you know, and taken a look at, I know Representative Parrish can help me with the name, DIPAC. That's what it is, yeah. And they do a great job, and they get a lot of fish out there and everything. So I think it's just time for look at this in a comprehensive, holistic approach and resolve, come up with something to resolve the issue that we have. But I do appreciate the question, and I appreciate your concern.
Mr. Verhagen has something, and then yes, follow up, and then Representative Westlake has a question too.
For the record, Elijah Verhagen, staff to Rep. Tallarico. I believe Alpheus Ballard is on the line, the lawyer that drafted this. Section 2 is kind of a housekeeping thing, is from my understanding of where it would fit under the duties of the department and duties of the commissioner. And so if he's online, he may be able to address Representative Josephson's question about Section 2 a little bit more as well.
Thank you. Mr. Bullard, are you online?
Good afternoon, Chair Tara, members of the committee. This is Alpheus Bullard, and yes, I'm online.
And so I think Representative Josephson's question under Section 2 was didn't want to have something that got ahead of efforts at rehabilitating wild salmon stocks. And so this section, you know, in making a finding that the plans and specifications for proposed construction work are used sufficiently to protect fish under and game under D of this section, the commissioner shall consider related fisheries enhancement projects under the section I think that's being added. Can you sort of comment on why Section 2 was necessary?
Chair Tarr, members of the committee, this is Alpheus of Ledge Legal. I was just conforming a section in existing law that has to do with the protection of fish and game with the existence of these new fisheries enhancement permits. The section of law that's being amended is 1605-871, Protection of Fish and Game, and it has to do with protection of waterways for Andromedas fish. And this was included as a conforming amendment because, because these rehabilitation permits are relevant to that effort. I don't know that it would allow anything that wouldn't be allowed otherwise. So I don't know that I have an answer to Representative Josephson's question.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess the first question is, what is a construction or work? If we could just preliminarily look at that definition, if you know where that is, if it exists, Mr. Bullard.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there is no set definition. You might ask the department what they've regulated underneath this statute to get some idea of what would be affected.
Okay, and a follow-up?
Through the co-chair for Mr. Bullard, I guess my concern is that the section in question is protection of waterways for anadromous fish. So that's the article, and so the topic is protecting anadromous fish. And in Section A of Section 1605-871, it sticks with that subject. And notes the importance of the spawning, rearing, or migration of anadromous fish. And Section 2, I understand it's conforming, but it seems to say, in effect, well, if there's some sort of construction or work, and that could include apparently hydraulic projects, diversions. I mean, I'd have to look at this, but that one of the ways to get to meet the requirements of the section would be to say that the fisheries rehabilitation projects, including a hatchery way upriver, would suffice. And so I guess my concern is that in a net sort of zero-sum situation, a commissioner might say, I'm willing to continue to sacrifice improvements of anadromous fish because I'm going to meet my fish goal in some other way. And I'm just concerned about what policy statement we're making there. And I don't know, am I misreading subsection E on line 30, page 4?
Maybe we'll have department staff also.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I don't believe that you're misreading it. I think that a hypothetical might be helpful in this instance. There may be constructions or works or uses that could not help but have an effect on existing anadromous fish populations. Or other fish populations. And so in those instances, it seems appropriate that the commissioner would be asked to consider these fisheries enhancement permits.
Okay. I have a couple other questions for the sponsor, but I think...
Mr. Bowers, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
For the record, Forrest Powers, Deputy Director, Division of Commercial Fisheries. No, I don't. I think Co-Chair Josephson and Mr. Bullard, their discussion accurately portrays the intent of that particular section.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay, a follow-up, and
sure.
Then we'll go to Representative West.
So for the sponsor and his assistant, I guess, one question that or concern that's been raised by wild salmon advocates is that by definition, these hatcheries are designed to replenish weakened stocks of wild salmon. That's the point. And the process of that replenishment could further weaken what is already weakened. That is, there's evidence that the wild salmon would suffer further. Is this a concern that you share, and is this something that you can sort of discuss?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yeah, I've heard that concern. Several people have brought up, well, you're going to about the diversity of the different genetics in the salmon. Although, you know, most of us wonder how diverse do they really get, because we know that they just don't scattershot. They usually go back to where they were produced, a kind of biological fact for sure. One of the issues that comes up, and I think I can't apply biology to this other than as this resource gets depleted and we get lower and lower numbers of wild salmon, but we continue to fish them. We're not supplementing any of the wild salmon right now with any other potential for any other kind of catch. We're just taking the supply that we have. And as we continue to do that, I look at it more like, are we just going to work our way to an extinction process? Is that where we're headed? I don't know. I mean, obviously, we would have to stop at some point if numbers get that low. So that's kind of, I think, probably better for when you hear about the Golcana, I think they can certainly explain that a little bit better than me. So, but while we're on it, one of the things that I think we want to talk about, when we talk about rehabilitation in stream, I think just about a month ago or so, we actually had a presentation of rehabilitation here in one of our PowerPoints that happened in the Tanana River near a historical structure in Delta Junction. I think you probably all remember that, near the park down there and everything. So they went in and rebuilt the riverbank so they could stabilize that so we didn't lose a part of that historical park and those buildings and everything. So when we have a project like this, and if we had a project, say, that was approved in that area, I would hate to think that we would make the fish suffer because we're these things are going to have to cohabitate with each other. We'll have bank destabilization, and they'll go in and stabilize a bank somewhere potentially to save a historic building and this and that and everything else. But I think the potential is still there, actually, to have the fish run in the Tanana River, even though we stabilized the bank. So I think that's probably Mr. Bueller's explanation of that was really good. Occasionally we'll have those things, And I think that they can exist. They can coexist together.
Mr. Verhagen?
Yeah, and Co-Chair Josephson.
And this is Mr. Verhagen.
For the record, Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Tallarico. We're requiring in this bill to release the unfed fry. So there's about a 9 to 10 day window where they don't even have to be fed. So they've been, they come out of the Alevin stage and they've fed on their yolk for weeks. And then they have this 10 day period where they don't have to be fed and they're, again required to be put back in the water before you feed them. So they will be mixing with the natural fish, but our argument is they are natural fish. We helped incubate them, but we didn't do anything else to them. And so when you put them right back in as unfed fry, they will be mixing with the natural fish as well. And then also when we get to him, Gary Martinick from the Gulkana Hatchery can speak to this as well because they've been doing this on the Gulkana River and Copper Center there for about 40 years. And so, and their fish, you can't tell the difference between the incubated fish versus the natural fish.
And I don't know, Mr. Bowers, because this is something that came up in the Fisheries Committee as well, and there was a discussion about the difference between, you know, trying to do enhancements for an entire fishery, right, so or, you know, versus enhancement for a stock, and how because this is more limited to just a stock, a particular, you know, river tributary, for example, that should minimize that risk. Could you please talk about that a bit more?
For the record, Forrest Bowers, Deputy Director, Division of Commercial Fisheries. Yeah, you know, the one of the things that hasn't been mentioned, you know, the under applications under this permit would be limited to 500,000 eggs. So it's a, you know, it's a relatively small number of fish. We do have a genetics policy that is meant to preserve genetic diversity of wild stocks, and so you know there would be stipulations on any person permitted under this bill that they would have to meet. There are minimum population sizes that would have to be met to ensure that genetic diversity of wild stocks is not compromised. That's a legitimate concern. Loss of genetic diversity, and it's something we take very seriously. And again, we do have a policy in place that tries to address that, Madam Chair.
And just if you could, just the difference between sort of, you know, an enhancement or project that would be directed towards an entire fishery versus this that's toward, you know, at the stock sort of level, and what makes that different?
Madam Chair, well, I think just the way you described it, I mean, you're and it depends on how you define a fishery. I mean, you could have a fishery, say a recreational or subsistence fishery, that targets a very small, discrete stock in a small tributary. Mm-hmm. And there's many examples of that across the state. You know, not every fishery is targeting a resource returning to a large drainage. You know, so this. You know, I imagine that projects that would be permitted under this bill, you know, they would be attempting to rehabilitate a stock that's a component of a larger resource. But certainly there could be a fishery or more than one fishery mm-hmm. that is directed at mm-hmm. some of these resources at small tributaries that would possibly be considered under this bill, Madam Chair.
And did you have one more follow-up, and then we'll try to go the other two real quick?
I think for through the co-chair for Mr. Bowers, is there any evidence that you know of that hatcheries of this sort have enhanced wild stock populations?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you know, we permit several different types of aquaculture projects intended to enhance or rehabilitate fish stocks. You know, our number one our number one tool there is the private nonprofit hatchery program. Those are the big hatcheries that we have around the state. And there's a few state-run hatcheries that are similar. The William Jack Hernandez hatchery in Anchorage, and we have another hatchery up in Fairbanks that that are state-run hatcheries. But that's our primary tool, the big private nonprofit hatcheries. Macaulay Hatchery here in Juneau, that's an example one. But we permit other projects. You've heard bioenhancement research projects mentioned. In 2016, we permitted 11 of those projects. The provisions of those permits are very similar to those contained in HB 107. The 500,000 egg limit is the same, and we have permitted some of those projects up in the Seward Peninsula, in particular, that have restored salmon stocks in streams that where salmon were extirpated due to mining activity. So there have been some positive outcomes up there. But as far as small scale projects like this, we just don't permit that many of them. We don't see that many requests.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Okay. Representative Wexler.
Yes, thank you, and through the Chair. Representative Josephson had asked a good question, and I don't know if you were here when Representative Birch was talking about the hatchery and on the NOTEC, actually. And I can tell you, the hatchery was successful. Speaking from personal experience out there, in the 1980s, the whole Constable area, the fishing population crashed. It was severe. It was an economic disaster. And the questions that came up today has me wondering when the hatchery has now been closed about 15 years. At what point does an androgynous fish become an indigenous fish? Because the year after, we're still getting them. And I still travel past the fish hatchery there. And it's teeming with the salmon that come up there because this is where they were born. So we have that. So 15 years after it's closed, we're getting it. Granted, our fisheries has never come back up to the point it did before. So I was really glad to see this bill. Well, thank you.
Did anyone want to comment on that or respond? Thank you. Okay. And I think we had a question from Representative Parrish. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of reservations about the bill as a whole. I got a degree in biology here in Juneau from University of Alaska Southeast, and go figure, we talked about salmon a bunch. And I did a research project on the Auk Lake salmon, and I worked for Fish and Game for a little bit. Had the pleasure of going to a few weirs, including Fraser Lake, which wasn't previously a salmon stream, but they put in a ladder, and now it's got a really robust run. So, and of course, we have DIAPAC here, so I'm not inherently opposed to fishery enhancements. But I am concerned that by giving a 19-fold competitive advantage to a subset of a population, as you would, according to your survival statistics, you're going to put a downward pressure on genetic diversity. That's just the way these things work. If you effectively increase a subset of the population's representation 19 times over, the remaining 1/20th will compose a smaller portion of the overall population. I really appreciate a lot of things in this. I really appreciate that it's into the same waters. I appreciate that they're unfed. I remain concerned about some other things, like hatchery fish. The fed ones tend to come out a lot more competitive. They're larger and stronger. You're avoiding that, and I really do commend you for it. That was wise. So that's one of my reservations. I'm concerned about the long-term downward pressure on genetic diversity, which this bill will result in. It also seems a little bit like if your house is on fire, it seems like a really cool glass of ice water. It's really great in the short term. But if you don't deal with the fact that your house is on fire, it's kind of some it's not going to be a long-term solution. The only, and that gets to the conversation that you wanted to avoid about the other factors, such as other fisheries pressures. I tend to think that climate degradation and changes in the, what's the term again? The timing mismatches in outmigration and in return with the larger blooms of prey when they outmigrate tend to be the larger factors. I'd also be really interested in seeing if there were a provision if a local population was not keen on having this happen in their traditional fishing area, if there's any mechanism for them to say no thank you and for the department to respond to that.
For the record, Elijah Verhagen, Staff Representative Tallarico. So to answer that last question real quick first, I guess, and then I'll answer some of the other ones. The answer is yes, they're part of the permit. As you'll see, the requirements of the permit on page 2, line 8, under B, says any communication or plan for continued communication from the applicant with affected persons, relevant organizations with applicable expertise and stakeholders in the project area. And then later on, there is on page 3, line 16, so if the proposed project is a salmon rehabilitation project, relevant and applicable comments relating to the proposed project submitted by a regional planning team established under that statute for the region that encompasses the project area. And so there are several things in here that the commissioner will be looking at when they look at an application and determining if they want to accept it or not. And so including that right there on that page 1 in the application, the reasonable communication that with interested and relevant parties and organizations and affected persons. So they would be able to have discussions and that's all documented, and then the commissioner would be able to see that and say, okay, you know, the locals aren't in favor of this or not. To answer your other questions about genetic diversity, in the late 70s and 80s, Fish and Game successfully planted over 20 million sockeye eggs in the upper Karlik River. And got them to restore the depleted run to pre-1921 populations. Since the 1970s, Fish and Game, again through the Gulkana Hatchery, has annually rehabilitates up to 40 million eggs per year in the Copper River watershed. Again, Gary Martinick's online, and he could probably answer your questions. Again, he's the expert, not me, about how what they do to continue with genetic diversity, because that is a very important aspect that we don't want to mess up. And then I would say, as was mentioned earlier, a lot of these salmon it's amazing, of course, as we all know, that they can find their way back to the same river that they were hatched in. And so over millennia of them doing that, and many times smaller rivers and creeks, often there's no evidence that we know of when they pick their mates of who to spawn with, that they could be from the same hatch coming back 5 years later, the same time frame as, you know, some of the other 5,000 eggs in a king salmon, and therefore they could be, you know, spawning with another fish from the same hatch, etc. So we again are getting them incubated, putting them right back in, as you were mentioning, and trying to keep them as natural as possible. But we believe that this, and again, Gary could maybe talk more about that. But then the department has their genetics policies, etc., that they'll be closely monitoring this to address those concerns, because we definitely don't want to. Those are real concerns. Thank you.
Representative Parrish, we have several people online, and we wanted to get to some public testimony.
I can hold my questions. Can you submit them separately?
Okay, and because we will be holding the bill today, but that way we will get to these folks. We will have to stick to the two-minute time limit today so we can get through everybody who is listening in. So I'm going to go to Gary Martinek, because it sounds like you have a lot of experience in this. Mr. Martinek, if you could please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Gary Martinek. I recently retired from working at Gulkana Hatcheries for 37 years. I'm testifying on my own behalf and for no group or organization supporting HB 107. The rehabilitation of salmon stocks is in a reasonable and responsible way where conditions allow. Gulkana Hatchery is located on a spring system adjacent to the Gulkana River, a tributary to the Copper River. The hatchery is 260 miles inland from the marine environment. It was started as a research project by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Fred Division in 1973 to see if there was an efficient, low-cost method of rehabilitating the heavily pressured Copper River sockeye salmon stocks. The hatchery is located on a spring system where the water temperature only varies 5 degrees from summer to winter, and it uses a simple, non-powered gravity feed system to get water from the spring to the incubators. From 1973 to 1980, it was primarily a sockeye research facility. From 1980 to 84, we increased production to 20 million eggs. By 1987, production increased to 36 million eggs, making it the largest sockeye salmon fry producer in the world. The basic premise was to increase the natural spring survival of survival of sockeye in the springs there from 13 to 16%. By putting them in an egg, taking eggs artificially and placing them into an incubator, survival was increased to as high as 95%, with 75% being the average historical survival. Once the fry emerge from the incubator, they are counted, otolith marked, and released at three nursery lakes where they spend 1 year before migrating to the sea. They deal with the same environmental and predation issues that all wild stocks have to overcome. 17% of the returning adult sockeye are four-year-old fish, 83% are five-year-old fish. The hatchery stock is just one stock of 136 sockeye stocks in the Copper River, and a very diligent management program goes hand-in-hand to ensure wild stocks remain healthy and that the commercial fleet, subsistence, personal use, and sport fisheries all benefit from the 350,000 to 400,000 annually produced hatchery salmon. The monetary value of production to all user groups since the hatchery started in 1973 has been $700 million. And I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony, Mr. Martinek. Any questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And thank you for your testimony, sir. How does the emergence date for your hatchery-raised Elvin compare with the emergence date for indigenous populations of salmon?
Well, like I said, in the spring, we did, again, originally in the 70s and 80s, we did research on that hatchery spring, and that's where we came up with the survival of only 13 to 16%. And that's, and again, that's, we started very small, and we, by just increasing and going through research, again, we've been able to increase it to the average is 75% survival.
And a follow-up?
Thank you. But when you reintroduce your fry to the stream, how do they compare developmentally with the wild grown?
Through the chair, they're basically, since I've been there, the same. They are the same fitness as the wild stocks there. And to answer the other question that people have been asking about genetic diversity, what you also have to realize is that there are wild fish coming into that spring before and after we do our egg take. And by looking at otoliths, that basically the wild stock component in the hatchery springs is still 47%.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. We are going to continue on. We're going to run a couple minutes over, but we will get to everyone before we finish today. Matthew O'Boyle from the Skagway Community Fish Hatchery.
Yes, Matt O'Boyle, Skagway Community Fish Hatchery. Before starting, I would like to thank everyone for giving me the opportunity to express my support for HB 107. Skagway Community Fish Hatchery is a newly founded nonprofit formed through the municipality here to address the low level of returning salmon here in Skagway. To give you a brief little history of Skagway's enhancement efforts, Skagway has been a collection and release site for king salmon in the past through a fish and game enhancement program encouraging stock diversification. But with the dwindling return rates, the rearing facility could not sustain involvement. So during the summer, we would collect and accumulate king salmon for egg retrieval and then transport them to DIPAC in Juneau to incubate them and return the smolt the following spring here in Skagway. A great deal of mortality has occurred in the transfer from Juneau to Skagway. And with the lack of eggs collected in previous years due to low return rates, Skagway is now currently seeing a closure to sport fishing of king salmon in northern Lynn Canal. Skagway also has a natural run of coho that, with the help of HB 107, we could bring them back to a reasonable population level. The underlying benefits of HB 107 are the economic and educational values. The tourist dollars brought in through sport fishing affects the community as a whole. And when you look at the infrastructure that is created for this resource, you have to look at how we can plant the seed for future generations. Skagway community has always been a big supporter of fish enhancement through volunteers and programs through the school, like Salmon in the Classroom. HB 107 gives an additional tool in educating our high school seniors that are interested in fisheries job and thus building on Alaska's future. I'd like to thank you guys for your time if you have questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, seeing no questions, we really appreciate your time today and waiting to get to the public testimony. We're going to go next now to Will Mayo from Tanana Chiefs.
Hello, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Will Mayo of Fairbanks. I'm the Executive Director of Tribal Government and Client Services. The experience that we had, we've been working with a few game, trying to develop a program that we could add to our toolbox for our fisheries, and we want to enhance or develop our capacities. Because in recent years we felt very vulnerable with the decline in our primary human consumption fish species and others in the past, we felt the need to develop capacity to what we discovered was that the current state permitting system had basically two permits, two types. We wanted to do a certain kind of project for rehabilitation, and the existing permits not work. We could not use them for the purpose that we wanted. Would provide a third permit that would enable us to proceed with our projects in close working relationship with the department. We do not in any way want to harm the wild stocks. We're not approaching it haphazardly. But we would like to develop the ability to enhance these stocks that we depend on if needed in the future. So that is our motivations and our concerns and the reasons why we want to give our hearty support to this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mayo. We appreciate your testimony. Question, Representative Birch.
Good to hear from you, Will, through the chair. I'm very encouraged to hear that we've got the broad base of support. How do you actually envision this moving forward? Would you deploy
individual incubation stations, or would it be like a central location, or have you given any thought to how this would move forward? I mean, it seems like a great idea. I just was kind of curious about the mechanics, if you will, through the chair.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Chair. To the representative, yes, we have just on staff. We are currently running various projects around the interior in different river systems, all within the Yukon drainage. And in those systems, we are doing counting stations, weirs, fish weirs, and so on. And so what we are doing is identifying spawning streams that we could make a project with to enhance the returns to that area. So working with Fishing Game and with our own staff, we've identified so that we're choosing where we want to start a project, and we have one system for moisture incubation, why we would take broodstock from the existing stream and incubate them and then return them either options. We could return them either as eyed at the eyed stage of the egg development. They have the most likelihood of continued survival. At that point, we could replant them into the gravel beds of the native spawning stream. The other option is the moist air incubation system until they reach the elephant stage where they emerge, and then we place them in their native stream. So, it just depends on the thing that they're going to be. I'll stop there and see if that answered your question.
Absolutely, through the chair. Thank you very much. Appreciate the feedback.
Okay. folks, we're going to try and go over a few minutes, so please hang in there. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just really appreciated hearing this bill, and I guess my question for the caller is, do you see anything, any negatives at all? I mean, we've heard good things, but any negatives? I mean, this seems like a good bill just all the way around.
I think Mr. Mayo just dropped off. Mr. Mayo just dropped off.
Okay.
So apologies, we lost him. Okay, we're going to go to Brian Windstaffer from Chickaloon Native Village. We're running a little short on time. If you don't have a full 2 minutes, that's okay, too.
Madam Chair, committee members, you hear me loud and clear?
Yep.
Okay, hey, my name is Brian Winstaff, and I work for Chickaloon Native Village in the Matanuska Valley, a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay, worked for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on the Yukon River Sonar Escapement Program back in the early 2000s, and I was working for HDR as a fisheries biologist consultant on the Pebble Project in Iliamna, also a member of the Matsu Borough's Fish and Wildlife Commission a while ago. Calling in support of HB 107, as everyone else seems to be. Chickaloon Village has worked on many fish population rehabilitation projects and many fish habitat restoration projects. One of our first fish passage restoration projects was on Moose Creek back in 2005, and we spent over $1 million of mostly federal funds rerouting the stream back into its original alignment after railroad activities in the early 1900s straightened the creek and created waterfalls that precluded fish passage, essentially deleting 11 miles of spawning and rearing habitat. So we fixed that. After rehabilitating the habitat, we began a project to restore fish numbers by implementing a moist air incubation project from 2007 to 2010. We partnered with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. The project and the process worked well, and our returns of salmon based on foot and aerial surveys remained level when similar stocks of fish in our area dwindled. Chickaloon Village has also replaced or rehabilitated many culverts under Matsu Borough and state roads that were not providing fish passage and were on their last stages of usefulness. Since there wasn't a fisheries rehabilitation permit, we had to apply for multiple permits, such as a fish resource permit and fish transport permit, with prior approval from the Cook Inlet Regional Planning Team. HB 107 would have been a permit that was apropos for our project and would have allowed the state to track the project better. that would have been labeled a rehabilitation project versus a science or education permit. All these projects represent local people taking an interest in the resources. Instead of an agency coming in and telling you what to do, we have excellent collaboration between agencies and local folks rehabilitating our trust resources. We were able to bring forward fish passage and population issues to the agencies, and we were able to leverage federal and state dollars to solve these issues. Again, mostly federal dollars were used for these projects. Passing HB 107 gets to the heart of these projects. The ability to rehabilitate a resource that has been impacted in the past is a win-win for the people of Alaska, all user groups, and the resource itself. Thanks for your time.
Excellent. Just barely over 2 minutes. Any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say good job to Chickaloon. They did a great job rehabilitating their stream, and I think you're really an example in a lot of ways, and appreciate you calling in and giving testimony.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. We really appreciate your testimony. We're going to go to Ricky Gies, Kenai River Sport Fishing.
Good afternoon. My name is Ricky Gies. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. I hate to be Debbie Downer, but I want to point a few things out. We sent a letter in, and we took an example of if you took 2,000 wild stock fish, for example, in the middle Nenana River, and you had 1,000 females and 1,000 males, and with your enhancement program, you just looked at 100 females with a survival rate of 95%. In the wild stock, you had 900 females with a survival rate of just 0.5%. Just in that one generation, you are reducing genetic diversity in terms of the enhanced portion that you worked on will compose two-thirds of the fry outgoing, and the wild stock will generate one-third. I understand low king returns. It's a statewide issue. We feel it here just as much as anybody else. There's a difference between a population that's been extirpated and you want to go in and rehabilitate and reintroduce that population versus trying to enhance low numbers of fish in a population. Low numbers of fish, we think the best strategy is to drastically reduce fishing pressure on those fish, maintain good habitat, which we have in Alaska, and let nature take its course. It's painful to go through these periods of low abundance, but it's really important that I think we do. You know, we were very supportive of the $30 million that we once had in king salmon research. That money, half of it, was taken out of the equation. We know budget cuts are a difficult type thing, but we don't think that this is the right path. I'll give you an example for hatchery components and enhanced components where you can get into a trap. On the Kenai River, if you come down, there's enhanced runs on Hidden Lake. Those fish now, about 90% of the returns are 1-2 fish. They're really small torpedo fish. They swim through dip nets. They swim through commercial nets. Nobody really likes them. But the majority of returns of sockeye in the Kenai are 2-2 fish and 2-3 fish, really large sockeye fish. And so this concept of loss of genetic diversity is really a critical one. And I think with today's department standards of strict separation between wild stocks and enhanced stocks or hatchery stocks, it's really important. Many of the marine waters, those are hatchery terminal fisheries, which don't go into anadromous streams. And I think that's really key going forward. And I think some more thought needs to go into this concept of loss of genetic diversity. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gies. We really appreciate your testimony today. If you have any specific ideas or amendments, please send those along. Representative Parrish had a question. Then we're down to the last three people that I'm desperately trying to get through before we get out of time.
Thank you. You said you had submitted a letter. Is that correct?
Yes, I think I emailed members of the House Resources Committee, so it's probably in your email box. So,
thank you.
Is that... that was your question?
Yeah, I don't see it in my supporting documents as well.
Okay, we'll make sure to track that letter down. If you could please resend that to my office, we'll make sure to get that to everyone.
Okay, will do.
Thank you so much. Okay, next thank we're you. Going to Nancy Hillstrand, Pioneer Alaska Fisheries in Kodiak.
Yes, hello. My name is Nancy Hillstrand. I have Pioneer Alaskan Fisheries. We've been in business in Alaska for 53 years.
also worked for the Department of Fish and Game for 21 years in hatcheries. I've raised all 5 species of salmon and 2 of trout. So I'm very aware of what this is, what you're talking about here in House Bill 107, and I'm against House Bill 107. The reason I am is I have seen a lot of problems with weakened wild fish. We're so blessed with our wild spawning salmon, and right now what we need to do more so than just putting fish in these river systems is doing what that fellow in Chickaloon just stated, which is fixing culverts, fixing the habitat, and most of all, going to the Board of Fisheries and saying, why are the fish up in Tanana, why are they not getting up that far? Because that has to do with some management problems downriver. We have worked really hard on the North Pacific Management Council to get them to stop some of the trawling bycatch and have been fairly successful. Maybe that will help. But to do this is to kind of put the cart before the horse, because fishing and fish populations do go up and down. The last spokesman talked about the Hidden Lake hatchery fish and what's happened there. There was a scientific paper actually written by Fish and Game stating how we do have risk with doing these kind of things, and it's called, if you Google Hidden Lake hatchery fish, you know, you'll be able to find it, and I'll be glad to send it to you, because it's very important that you read some of these scientific papers that show that we do damage to our wild fish. Oregon, Washington, Vancouver, they've all done damage. There's many scientific papers showing that this kind of activity, enhancement, can be very detrimental, because the fish come out from, especially if someone feeds them, and if they have these fish released out of the gravel, I can see that they would definitely want to feed them and make them more of an aggressive predator on the other little fish, and they outcompete them. So please, the RPTs that are mentioned in this on the last page, it talks on the regional salmon plans. The RPTs were restructured within Fish and Game, so most of those are hatchery people that worked for the Aquaculture Association. They are no longer made up of Fish and Game. I mean, they might have the name of Fish and Game, but it's really important we look at who these people are that are taking care of our supposed wild fish. And so please, please take care of our wild fish. We have other ways to do rehabilitation, which is totally separate from enhancement. Thank you very much. They also need to be defined.
Thank you, Ms. Hillstrand. Really appreciate your testimony. Could you please send in written testimony? That would be helpful to be able to follow up on some of the items that you mentioned.
Yes, I will. Thank you very kindly.
Okay. With very much appreciation to committee members for staying these couple extra minutes, we have Bruce Kane from Copper Basin Chamber of Commerce.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. This is Bruce Kane. I'm the president of the Copper Valley Chamber of Commerce, and I would testify in support of House Bill 107. The you know, our members of the Chamber of Commerce, are a lot of them are sport fishing guides, and this year on the Copper River, the sport fishing season for king salmon has been closed because of a lack of return. We do have the Gulcana hatchery, and the Gulcana sockeye run is strong. That's about a 300,000 return from that. That has been going on since 1977. And the Copper River fisheries is one of the best managed fishery in the world, and it's done very well. And we've said we don't want to become like the Yukon River, and the hatchery is one of the reasons for that. But we don't do any king salmon enhancement on the Copper River, and now we're faced with a year where everything is closed because of lack of return on the king salmon. So those are issues that we have to balance our efforts, and these incubation boxes are not really an issue of genetic diversity. They come from the wild stocks. They're hatched out just like wild stocks. And it's a good system. It's a non-intrusive system, and it's been tested and proven for many years to be successful. And I would support it and encourage you on behalf of our members that are our sport fishing guides now are going to go do drywall work this summer. I don't know what they're going to do, but they're not going to be sport fish guiding. So that's the final end on this. You know, you can close the fisheries and, like happened on the Yukon, and sit around and hope things come back, or we can take care of ourselves. And part of it is this approach with House Bill 107. I think it's a good approach, and I support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Oh, Representative Wesley.
Through the chair. Thank you for calling in, Bruce. I appreciate your testimony.
Okay, excellent. And finally, Mr. Brian Ashton, who is here in the room, thank you so much for your patience and everyone else for sticking around. We'd love to hear your testimony.
Good afternoon. This is Brian Ashton. I'm from Wrangell, Alaska. I'm representing myself, and I'm here on request of Mr. Tallarico to help answer any questions because I've been involved in salmon restoration for over 15 years. I was involved in development of some of the mega hatcheries in southeast Alaska, helped develop some of the technologies that's being used. What I realized being raised in villages, in Huna in this case, is that we need to find a balance with how we help these fish survive. We're certainly very good at taking them. And I've dealt with fishing game for many, many years. I'm in support of House Bill 107 simply because it fills in a gap that exists today for being able to do this effectively and have good controls on when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate. We're basically trying to make other permits that aren't appropriate fit the bill. I appreciate Fish and Game for the years that they've done it, helping make those permits fit. But this simply clarifies how to do it, when it's appropriate to do it. And I'll very, very quickly, just a couple of seconds, review some of the things that people brought up in opposition. I believe that it was overstated about the numbers of basically overwhelming the genetic stocks of the fish. When you go talk to the genetics policy and the fisheries managers and Fish and Game, they talk about specifically the numbers of how many fish you're going to enhance because they've had decades of experience looking at what the ratio would be of those wild fish spawning compared to you greatly increasing the survival of the wild fish by assisting their survival. So they don't just go do 500,000. They'll look at what the escapement is, what the numbers are, and say, let's talk about doing this to make sure that we don't overwhelm the natural stocks, in spite of the fact that these fish are wild fish as well. And the Copper River Enhancement Program, 40 million eggs a year for decades, and the stock is still well. No, I don't have to say anything more about that. There are stocks of fish that have not come back. The Bradfield River was a mutant-sized fish on a par with the Kenai River just south of Wrangell. It got logged down to the watershed. It was never restored. The habitat was never restored. It should be a Superfund project. We're going to be working on getting that restored. But the stock is so far down in its numbers that it's never going to it may return eventually, but it would take decades and decades to do it. When we can basically go in there, capture that remnant stock, and bring that back. And we're talking about fish that were producing Kenai king salmon-sized kings in southeast Alaska. As oil continues to diminish, I think it's critically important that we look at our natural reoccurring stocks, like in the case of salmon, and make sure we're helping them as much as we can. Tribes and Prince of Wales have spent over 10 years restoring the habitat in the watersheds, but the stocks are down so much, they look at this as the only option to know that they've restored the habitat to reintroduce the fish that are gone that have not come back for decades. There is not going to be any feeding. I helped write this bill in collaboration with Fish and Game. We looked at very conservative regulations to make sure that this policy could not be abused. We must protect the wild stocks and the nature of the wild stocks. And to compare this process to taking king salmon in the lower states, Washington, Oregon, and California, feeding them all the way to the smolt stage, in other words, not only incubating them, but rearing them in pans for a year and then letting them come back, absolutely dramatic difference in what we're proposing here compared to a conventional hatchery down there. The regional planning teams, by law, I believe, have to have Fish and Game staff on those teams. So it is good to question that, to say who's going to be approving these things in the regional planning teams, but Fish and Game serve on those boards, and as far as I'm concerned, they'll be serving on the boards perpetually forever. I think that some of the concerns that people had, I appreciate Co-Chair Tarr and asking them to write in, because I think that some of these people that have called in will be able to basically systematically answer and provide information, and Fish and Game will be able to provide information specifically on how they're addressing genetic diversity and things like that. So when you guys hold the hearing again, Thank you for your time.
Just a fast question.
Thank you. A couple questions here. Representative Josephson.
Yeah, through the chair, Mr. Ashton, what made this a Superfund site and what hurt the habitat in Prince of Wales?
It's not a Superfund site on the Bradfield, but I suggested it should be considered one because...
Why? Why? How did it get that way?
The U.S. Forest Service basically oversaw logging where they actually took gravel out of the river to make the logging roads back in the 60s and 70s. Lowered the entire floodplain within the water system and simply decimated the watershed.
And Prince of Wales is a similar sort of answer.
Prince of Wales had logging that was right under the watershed as well. They've taken great steps because the communities are close enough to it in collaborating with state, federal agencies, and other environmental groups have funded the restoration of that habitat.
Thanks.
Okay, we have to vacate the room. We've got 30 seconds here. Representative Birch and Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to, I don't know if you've seen it, but we received a letter of concern from the Kenai River Sports Fishing Association worrying about the biologic diversity. I'm an engineer, not a biologist, but I would like to provide that letter to you if you haven't seen it and would appreciate your comment between now and our next meeting.
I'll comment, but I'll especially make sure it gets to the genetics lab with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who absolutely has the best genetic policies in the world. Great. On protecting our stocks of fish. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pears.
Good to see you again, Mr. Ashton.
You too.
I'm terrible at faces. You changed your hair. It's good to see you. One of the things you mentioned was the possibility of restoring stocks to streams where the salmon are currently not returning. Is that right? Would that be permitted under the bill as it stands? It talks about taking eggs from one set of waters and returning them to the same waters.
The watersheds that I'm referring to actually have a remnant stock, but it's so low it can't be expected to recover for very, very long times because they are so low.
I see. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, thank you, Mr. Ashton. We are adjourned, and I think it's about 3:16 or 17.